Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Massini. This is the final installment of our partnership with the Spokesman Review and their Summer Stories short fiction series. In this episode, we'll hear two stories, Summer of Love by Tom Caraway, followed by Magnificent Desolation by Jess Walter. This year, the theme of the Spokesman's Summer Stories was Summer of 69. And each author was challenged to interpret that theme in their own way. Now, here's author Tom Caraway reading his story, Summer of Love.
Summer of Love. You know what the problem is, don't you? Paul leaned forward. It had been a hot day, but evening settled in cool. It smelled like grass and hot concrete. Al knew this look, the tone. "Geez, Paul, can't you wait until we start drinking?" He poured the scotch. Earl took his glass. "Thanks, Al. Glad you came around to the Islay stuff." He settled his big frame back against the patio chair, sniffing the glass. "The best." Al held his glass up, shot a warning look to Paul. "Welcome back, friends. To you, to us." He tapped the glass on the bar, then raised it to his lips. Earl looked delirious as he took his first drink. "I still live in Spokane, you know. You don't have to welcome me back." Paul set his drink down. "Have you been talking to my pops again, Paul? You sound all, I don't know, belligerent?" Al looked at Paul over the rim of his glass. "I'm going to be burping Pete for a week." Paul scowled and drew in breath, a red splotch creeping up his neck. They'd been playing the game of who can make Paul explode for 35 years. Earl cut in before Paul could say anything more than, "I think it's cool your pops is here. Like old times. He doesn't seem any worse than he was. I mean, he lights stuff on fire. Boomers, man. How'd you get him to leave his guns behind?" Al's youngest son, Lloyd, age 12, sauntered past, giving his dad and his friends side eye. Al took another drink, smiling. "What was that?"
"What?"
"I told you guys about Carrie." "Yes, Earl, it's been over a year, and you sent us 100 texts the night it happened. You also posted on Facebook and created an Instagram dedicated to burning her things." Earl lit a cigarette. "She's remarried. Anyway, you getting any sleep, Paul? Little one keeping you up all night? About time." Paul almost choked. "That was fast." He wiped his chin. "No sleep." "Al, how did you get your pops to threaten to cut off his internet?" "Did you guys see that thing? Dad!" Al's daughter called from somewhere. "Mom says to start dinner." Paul stood up with Al. "What's the theme this year? Oh yeah, teach Earl to cook. Again. How many years is it now? 7? Earl shook his head at Paul. They'd known each other since first grade. "Drink faster, bud." "Anyway, you can't cook until we're properly inspired. Time for some tunes. Tradition, boys." Paul went in the back door. Al followed. Earl grabbed a bottle, then followed. "How about this? Sound familiar? Name that tune." Earl and Al both said Pearl Jam before the music started. Jerks. Paul looked into the living room, where the remaining wives had huddled with the baby, Paul and Ellie's first, barely 3 months old. "Hey girls, think baby is ready to learn about Gen X?" If there was a response, Al didn't hear it. Paul stayed in the dining room, bopping his head. The ice in his glass clinked from side to side. "This open concept thing is really working out, Al. I like how open it is." Al looked at Paul. "You can see the whole house, man." "The remodel was a year in." "Yeah," Earl said. "And those 2x4 cabinets are pretty cool. You make those?" Al shook his head. "You get used to it. It all works, at least." Pops came down the stairs. "When's dinner? It's getting late." "It's 6:30, Pops. Coming right up." Pops walked into the kitchen. "What is this garbage on the radio? Thought you outgrew that crap." "Ain't nothing on the stove. You grilling? Girls are all in the living room." He kept walking, out the back door. Al pulled many things out of the fridge, then started chopping onions. "Want me to do anything?" Earl said. Al shrugged. Paul had disappeared into the living room, but hustled back when side one ended. "Change it!" Pops called from the patio. Al nodded at Paul. "Stones." Paul put on Let It Bleed. Gimme Shelter came on. By the time the onions were sautéed, garlic and red peppers had been added, and the girls had had enough of the Rolling Stones. "Hey!" Pop said from the back. Lloyd came in from the patio and sidled through the kitchen, smirking. Al turned on the Bluetooth speaker and pulled his phone out of his pocket, selected a playlist, and hit play. Black Hole Sun came on. Nice, Earl said. Al nodded toward the shrimp. Earl shook his head. Paul came in from the dining room. What gives, man? We always do vinyl the first night. I know. Sorry, but can you peel those shrimp? Earl smiled at Al. Al SMH'd. Earl, you know how to put water in a pot? Earl shrugged. It's Washington, brother. I can do all kinds of things with pot. He took the soup pan and turned the water on. Paul pulled tails off the shrimp. Born to Run came on. It's all the Koch brothers, Dark Money, and the NRA, obviously. The NBA? Earl asked. The water overflowed the pot. Paul's eyes bugged. Man, seriously. From the back door, Pop said, I gotta hear this. Paul went back to the shrimp. Al pointed with his knife. You deveining those two? No shrimp poops. Paul scowled. Al pressed out some dough and started feeding it through the pasta roller. Earl refilled everyone's glasses. Smells Like Teen Spirit came on and the boys all paused. Pops laughed in the doorway. That dough rise long enough? Can you believe my girls are going to college? Earl said. College. A lot of good that'll do 'em, Pops said. Easy, Pops. Who poured you that drink? Pops's rum and coke was full. There was neither rum nor coke in the kitchen or on the patio. I'm serious. College is a trap. You all gotta know that. Well, whose fault is that? Paul had a tiny knife in his hand, butterflying the shrimp, using his thumb and the tip of the knife to pull the vein out. The MBA, Earl ventured, nodding. I teach college, Pops. Al waved his tongs around. You're welcome. Don't know how that happened, Pops muttered. Al shook his head but said nothing. Student loans, man, Paul said. Hope your girls aren't taking out any loans, Earl. It's a trap. Earl giggled, then, in a Star Wars voice, It's a trap! Lloyd poked his head around the corner. Meme! Then disappeared again. California Dreamin' came on. Is that water boiling? Al glanced at the stove. Earl, man, the ladle is on fire. The wooden handle had gotten pushed over the gas burner. Phoebe, Al's daughter, who just started driver's ed, floated into the kitchen. This song is beautiful. What's for dinner? That's my generation right there, kiddo, Pop said. Made music right, we did. Looks like pasta, sweetie, Al said, shaking a handful of noodles in her direction. Lloyd burst from around the corner and tackled his sister, just this year shorter and lighter than him. Al's wife yelled, Not in the house, from the living room. The baby started crying, and Paul ran for the living room. Lloyd ran past Pops out the back. Phoebe got up, big dramatic eyes and arms out. What the frick? Pops followed Lloyd out back. Wait, Phoebe said. This is Grandpa's music? How is that a thing? Paul tossed the shrimp in the saute pan and laughed. They weren't always like this. I heard that, from the back. Grandpa, were you at Woodstock? My teacher was telling us about Woodstock and the Summer of Love, all that. That was you? Pops drank from his rum and coke. Wild World came on. The baby'd stopped crying. But how? It's hard to say. Paul came back into the kitchen. It's not that hard. They sobered up from the 60s and 70s and turned into yuppies, then drove it all into the ground. He was on the verge of wound up. And they continue to do so! A bit of muttering, and Al thought he heard Merrick Garland's name under Paul's breath. Earl had his head in his hands. Al put the colander in the sink and chopped some basil. It's not like they said, hey, let's drive it all into the ground. The Koch brothers, have you read? That's exactly what we did, from the back. Dad, I smell smoke. That's just the planet, Phoebe, Paul said, then yelled at the back door. There's no deep state, you lunatic. It just always seems like that, sweetie. Dinner was ready. Lloyd came up from under the table, into his seat. Pops ambled in from the back. The girls appeared from the living room. Quiet, the baby's asleep. It was the point at which Earl might have been in his boxers, but they were all more mature now. High hopes came on. Smells yummy. What's this? Is there bread? I'll get some butter. Al finished grating the Parmesan and brought it to the table. Earl settled into his chair and sniffed. Anybody need anything? We're fine, sweetie. You're fine. Panic! We couldn't change things. We tried. We couldn't? I really think the house is on fire, Dad. This is delicious. I love butter. Shh, the baby.
That was Tom Caraway reading his short story, Summer of Love, originally published in the August 24th issue of the Spokesman Review as part of this year's series of summer stories. Next, we'll hear Jess Walter reading his contribution to this year's Summer Stories, which all centered on the theme Summer of 69. Here's author Jess Walter.
Magnificent Desolation. I have a crush on the mother of my worst student. I suppose crush might seem an odd word for someone my age, 50, but it's an apt one. I feel crushed by this woman who appears in my classroom doorway to talk about why her son is failing seventh grade science. Abigail Cullen is ethereal. She wears a white skirt and a dark blue top that remind me of the upper atmosphere, where the stratosphere meets the mesosphere. Hey, I'm a science teacher, not a poet. Please, I say, come in. My sister calls my job teaching cats to fetch. It feels that way at times, the utter disinterest. I'll think, that was a good lesson, and I'll look up to see 25 dull-eyed, comatose stares. But sometimes I'll see a student light up over a lesson on tectonic plates or the property of waves, and I'll think, maybe I've awakened a soul. That's what science is to me, the awakening of the soul, the process by which we contemplate the deepest mysteries of our very existence. I was destined to teach science. I was born July 20, 1969, the day men first walked on the moon. While my father sat watching the lunar landing on the waiting room television, a surgeon delivered me from my dying mother, who had a massive blood clot in her lung. I came into this world as my mother left it, as Neil Armstrong stepped onto the chalky surface of a new world and said, "That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind." Armstrong later claimed that what he actually said was, "One small step for a man." This upset people because that Article A seemed to diminish what was a vast human endeavor. But in some ways, a man makes more sense. If Armstrong had meant man in the broader sense, like mankind, he would have in essence been saying, "That's one small step for mankind, one giant leap for mankind." Few people remember what was said by the second man to walk on the moon, my hero, Buzz Aldrin. "Beautiful view," said Buzz, to which Armstrong replied, "Isn't that something? Magnificent sight out here." Then Buzz uttered two words which still give me goosebumps, expressing the paradoxical nature of our miraculous existence on this life-giving rock in the exurbs of a cold, hard universe. Magnificent desolation. "We don't believe in that," Jacob Cullen said the first week of class. He was explaining why he didn't do the assignment on plant life cycles. It was nothing controversial. Photosynthesis, vascular versus non-vascular structure, that sort of thing. "You don't believe in plants?" I said. "Sex," Jacob said. He was a slight 12-year-old with intelligent eyes and a constant half-smirk. "You don't believe in sex. You're not allowed to teach it to me." "I'm certainly not teaching you about sex. You said sperm." The lesson was about angiosperms and gymnosperms, plants that reproduce using flowers and fruit versus plants that use cones to reproduce. "We don't believe in that," Jacob said. "God made plants." This became a pattern. Whatever I taught, cell structure, heredity, geology, Jacob Cullen would approach my desk after class. "We don't believe in that." "You don't believe in rocks. You said some rocks are 4 billion years old. How is that possible when the Earth is only 7,000 years old?" My unit on the moon was the last straw. I looked up. There he was. I sighed. "What don't you believe in now, Jacob? The moon? Tides?" "God hung the moon," Jacob said, "and the moon landing was faked." This is when I finally emailed Jacob's parents. I can't stop staring at Abigail Cullen's angular face, her jet black hair tied back against that elegant forehead. "Have us a seat," I say, my hand shaking as I gesture to a student's desk. "Is Mr. Cullen coming?" "Jacob's dad is playing golf," she says. "We're divorced." "Oh, I'm sorry," I say, and blurt out, "Me too. I mean, not golf, divorced. Monica left 15 years ago. She said I was distant and unreachable. I wish I could argue that description, but I've always had difficulty expressing emotion. When anger or joy arise in me, it feels like I'm in a spacesuit, separated from the world. I don't like to make excuses, but my therapist suspects it's related to growing up without a mother. My palms are sweaty. My voice cracks. Can I get you something? She looks around. Like what? It's a fair question. We are in a science classroom, not a martini lounge. I don't know what's the matter with me. I reach for a chemistry beaker. Liquid volcano? I think I'm fine, thank you. Of course, every teacher has to deal with fundamentalism from time to time. I have a respectful speech I give parents about science and religion, ending with my hero. Do you know the first thing Buzz Aldrin did when he landed on the moon? He took communion. He believed science and religion complement one another because both seek to understand the great mysteries, one through hypothesis and experimentation, the other through parable and metaphor. The Bible is not metaphor, an angry father said once. It's the absolute word of God. I smiled. But even Jesus spoke in parables. Science is Satan's PR department, the man said. How do you respond to that? This may be why Buzz Aldrin is my hero. In 2002, a conspiracy theorist was harassing him outside a hotel, insisting the moon landing was faked. Several times Buzz turned away, but the man just kept hounding him, calling him a liar and a coward. I have watched the video of what happens next maybe a dozen times. The 72-year-old former astronaut hauls off and punches the man. This is the moment Buzz Aldrin became the hero of science teachers everywhere, the patron saint of not taking any more of this crap. Let me start by saying I'm not trying to demean anyone's faith, I tell Mrs. Cullen. What I'd like Jacob to learn is the difference between belief and proof. I am lost in her bark brown eyes. I clear my throat. For instance, you could choose to not believe in gravity, but it won't change what happens when you step off a curb. Same with evolution or climate change. These are not opinions, but processes widely observed, studied and proven by scientific method, whether a certain church or politician agrees with them or not. She cocks her head as if she's not quite following. I don't think it's fair to limit a child to the knowledge that was available 2,000 years ago, I say. Just as it wouldn't be right if Jacob got a terrible infection to only give him frankincense because that was the medicine available in biblical times. I see Jacob's smirk rise on her face. And this is when all hope drains from my body. This is no longer just about one boy and his religious parents. This is about what's wrong with our country. From the top down, the deep divisions created by cynical people cherry-picking facts or ignoring them altogether, and the lazy and greedy, the willfully ignorant, the fake videos fed by social media algorithms. Look, I say, I'm sorry, but if two intelligent people like you and I can't get past a bunch of medieval fears and superstitions, centuries of bigotry and backward thinking, then what chance does humanity have against the serious existential threats we face? Not if we're wasting our time arguing over whether the moon is real. Did he say the moon isn't real? She burst into laughter. Mr. Wells, I think my son is having some fun at your expense. We are not religious. Jacob hasn't been to church since he was baptized. He is, however, about to get crucified. She smiles. Metaphorically, I mean. Apparently, Jacob is failing science because his teacher is a drunk. Mr. Wells forgets to assign readings and doesn't grade tests. Everyone in the class is failing. Everyone, I ask. That's quite a curve. Oh yeah, it's an open secret, Mrs. Cullen says. No one says anything because Mr. Wells was in a terrible accident. An accident? I almost admire Jacob's creativity. His wife and children were killed, she says. He drinks to forget. I'll bet he does. How many children? Two. Ah, the twins, I say. Reason and hope. She shakes her head. I'm sorry, Mr. Wells. Since the divorce, he's been acting out like this. He told his PE teacher he can't play floor hockey because he has lupus. We are still laughing when Mr. Cullen comes in. What's so damn funny, he asks. He is tall and balding, thick like a former football player. He's still wearing his golf clothes, even his glove. His face is flushed, and it's clear he's been drinking, working up his anger. He strides toward me. I don't care what happened to you, he says. You got no right to take it out on these kids. Mike, calm down, his ex-wife rises. I'm not going to calm down. He is coming around my desk. I rise and hold my hands out. There's been a misunderstanding. Mike, stop it, Abigail says. It's Jacob. He's saying he doesn't believe in science, that the moon landing was fake. Mike Cullen looks confused. So what, he says. I don't want some drunk failing my kid for that. He is right in front of me now, his hands balled up in fists. Besides, the moon landing was faked. I just saw a video about that. They couldn't have flown through the Van Allen radiation belts without... I don't even remember throwing the punch. We jokingly call it our first date, Abigail driving me to the emergency room. The injury looks worse than it is. A broken zygomatic arch, the narrow piece of cheekbone between the jaw and ear. It's a quick fix, maxillofacial surgery, like popping the dent out of an old car. The whole thing sobers Mr. Cullen up. I could probably be fired for punching him, but my weak blow barely grazed his jaw, while his more practiced shot broke my face. So, thankfully, there's no talk of pressing charges or filing complaints. I'm sorry, Mr. Cullen says, as I hold paper towels against my bleeding nose. It's okay, I say, but I have to tell you one thing. While lengthy exposure to the Van Allen belt would cause huge problems, simply flying through them on a spaceship exposes you to about the same amount of radiation as an X-ray. Okay, he says. I'm so humiliated, I tell Abigail on the drive to the hospital. I go 50 years without punching anyone, only to lose it over the Van Allen radiation belt. She smiles. Don't be embarrassed. Mike's an ass. I just wish you had better aim. I promise her I will train harder for my next defense of the scientific method. Our second date is to Manitou Park, where Jacob is doing an extra credit assignment on plant reproduction while his mother and I walk the gardens. The swelling has gone down in my face. Angiosperm? Jacob asks as he examines the bursting crimson leaves of a Japanese maple. That's right, I say. His mother and I are standing in dappled sunlight on a wooden footbridge watching him. Magnificent, isn't it?
That was Jess Walter reading his story, Magnificent Desolation, originally published in the August 31st edition of the Spokesman Review. After he read his story, Jess and I sat down to talk about science, the moon, and this year's Summer Stories theme. So, Jess, this year's Summer Stories prompt was the summer of 69. So when you got that prompt, how'd you go from that to this particular story?
I think every time I get a prompt, my first thought is, what can I get away with? How far can I get from it? So I started writing a story about the sack of Rome in 1469, and then I started writing a futuristic story in 2069, and I just so wanted to avoid hippies and things like that, just because it felt like there was this lane we were all going to fall into. But I actually was born on July 20th, not 1969, but 1965. Mm-hmm. So I have this special affinity for the moon landing. And lately I've had two people try to convince me the moon landing was faked. And so rather than take it out on them in public, I decided to write a story about how frustrating this time is when, you know, the simple, the most basic facts all of a sudden are under dispute.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. I mean, this story seems to be rooted in not necessarily this political moment overtly, right, but at least this moment of fake news or not knowing what to trust.
I wish it were only a political moment, because then an election could solve it. But it's a cultural moment. It's the access to so much information that then is fed to you in these rivers. And the rivers, if you look up one conspiracy, you will be bombarded with them. Mm. That's how the algorithm works. And you will go, you know, you'll find one thing after another that questions, you know, your basic beliefs. And this tribalized idea of information is what I think is more damaging even than the politics of the moment.
And so this story ends with sort of the pro-science character triumphing and yeah, even...
Sort of triumphing. He does get his face broken.
He gets the girl, though.
He does get the girl. He does get the girl.
And he even sort of makes up with Mr. Cullen.
Yeah.
So is that, does that represent some hope that you have for our cultural moment to move past this?
Yeah. The last time this happened, someone really did go on to me about the Van Allen radiation belt. And I was too dumbfounded to say, that's like getting, you know, you get more radiation from your microwave. You know, I just sort of muttered and stumbled. But yeah, I mean, I feel like when presented with facts, most people do become reasonable, you know. Many don't, but so yeah, I think, you know, it was this hopeful moment. It's also, you sort of end up getting lost in the characters, and you've got this science teacher that you're sort of rooting for to come out of his shell anyway, you know. Although I kind of wish he'd landed the punch. That would have been a lot more satisfying than getting the girl, maybe.
Yeah. Well, I've been talking with Jess Walter, author of Magnificent Desolation, the short story featured in this year's Summer Stories in the Spokesman Review. Thanks, Jess.
Thanks, Chris.
You've been listening to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. If you missed any of our Summer Stories episodes, which featured all 10 stories from this year's Spokesman Review short fiction series read by their authors, you can find them at SpokanePublicRadio.org or on the Bookshelf podcast, which is available on Google Play, Apple Podcasts, or the NPR One app. Join us tomorrow as we begin this new book.
Tune in this week to The Bookshelf to hear The Desk on the Sea, a new memoir written and read by me, Jonathan Johnson. Join my family and me in the Scottish town of Crail as we explore the highlands and the coast, the hills and the waves of joy and grief. You can listen Monday through Thursday at 6:30 p.m. on KPBX 91.1 FM or by tuning in online at SpokanePublicRadio.org.
The Desk on the Sea begins tomorrow, right here on The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio.